The whole premise of the introduction I'm going to give today is that one of the most common arguments, either against radical change in general or against socialism in particular, is that it's good in theory, but it'll never work because you can't change human nature. Either because people are too greedy, too competitive, that someone will always clamber their way to the top and begin exploiting and oppressing others, or that there have always been rulers and ruled and there have always been rich and poor, and there's just not much you can do about it. So what I'm going to argue today is that even though some of that can seem like common sense from time to time, it's by no means good sense. That, you know, human nature is far from static and is a lot more complex than what is usually presented. So to give away give the game away a bit, I'm going to be arguing that human nature is certainly not a barrier to socialism. That, you know, capitalism or the other exploitative and unequal forms of society we have seen are by no means more natural, by no means more in tune with human nature than any other given way of running the world. So I'm going to be arguing that socialism, so a society of genuine mass democracy, a society where the decisions about what is made, how it's distributed, where the decisions about the priorities and the structure of the world are down to the mass participation of those who actually produce all the wealth, those who actually do all of the work, a genuinely democratic and equal society, free from war, free from oppression, free from exploitation, this world is entirely possible. And what stands in our way is not something inherent about humanity. Now, I'm going to break it up into two parts, so to speak. One will be an argument against some of the common sense assumptions that, you know, either there have always been rich and poor and rulers and ruled and so on, and hopefully to try and take on some of the, I guess you could call it pseudoscience that gets about, you know, the sort of claims that there is something biologically or genetically programmed about people that drives toward inequality and so on. And the other component will be an attempt to explain the world today where there patently is inequality, there patently is oppression, there patently are greedy people. There are obviously people that do take up things like racism and sexism and so on. So an attempt to explain that and put an argument for one, how it's got nothing to do with human nature, but two, how it can be overcome and how these things can change. So to start, I guess, a useful way of trying to come at the question is to look at what has been considered human nature throughout the ages. Because you think about the common way that human nature is presented today, that human beings are individualistic, that we are inclined to compete against one another, that everyone is inclined to do what's best for themselves at the expense of others, that people are inclined to things toward like racism and so on, to make arbitrary distinctions and to do what's good for them and sort of climb their way to the top by clambering on the backs of others. It's sort of a neoliberal view of human nature. Well, you know, you don't need to look back far in history to see that, well, even a couple of hundred years ago, this idea didn't have much weight at all. You think about the sort of society that came before capitalism, where you had, you know, feudalism in Europe, the society of, you know, the kings and the queens, the dukes, the duchesses, the barons on one side, and then the mass of the peasantry and so on the other. Patently an exploitative society, patently an unequal society, but what was pushed as human nature then? There wasn't much talk about individual competition. There wasn't much talk about individual greed. No. The way that they justified feudalism was to say that, well, it's the divine will of God that means if you were born a lord, it's in your nature to lord it over everyone else. It's in your nature to be essentially a parasite and grow fat off the work of others. Whereas if you're a peasant, the way that this society was justified was by saying, well, it's human nature. It's given by God that you were born a peasant. You were born to toil the land. You were born to work for others. There was no talk of individual competition. There was no talk about, you know, an individual striving so that you could one day become the lord. The idea that some peasants in, you know, medieval Europe or something would somehow compete and strive and, you know, step on everyone else and would end up being king. Well, this didn't happen. So I think you can see that as society has changed, the idea of what's human nature, the idea of what's natural, has changed along with it. And one of the far more compelling arguments, I think, is to look back a bit further than that, to take in the real broad sweep of human history. Because it simply has not been the case that for the vast bulk of the time humanity has been on the planet, there have been exploitative societies. Because, well, it's true about, you know, capitalism, feudalism, the sorts of despotisms and that came before it. All of these were based on a tiny exploitative minority living off the backs of everyone else. That's true. But for about the first 100,000 years, for about the first 95% of human history, there's been no evidence whatsoever to show that there's been exploitation, that there's been oppression in any sense that you think about it today. In short, for the vast bulk of human history, for, as I say, about 95% of human history, the first 100,000 years or so that humanity in a modern sense has been around, there were no rulers and no ruled. There were no bosses and there was no exploitation. Now, you can, on one level, you could do an entire introduction just about this, so I'm just going to have to go over it very briefly. If people are interested, Sandra Bloodworth gave a presentation, I think yesterday morning, going over one society along these lines in more detail, so maybe it's worth checking out that if you're interested. But just to quote a few of some of the better-known archaeologists and anthropologists that have studied early human history in that sense. Well, Charles Turnbull, for instance, writes that there were no chiefs, no formal councils. In each aspect of life, there were maybe one or two people more prominent, but usually for good practical reasons. Maintenance of law was a cooperative affair. In short, people cooperated in order to live, in order to survive, without needing to either bow to some ruler, without needing to be subordinated to some boss, and without engaging in endless, needless strife with one another. Eleanor Laycock, another renowned anthropologist, writes of the society she studied that there was no private land ownership, no specialisation of labour beyond that of sex. People made decisions about activities for which they were responsible, and consensus was reached within whatever group would be carrying out joint activities. Some of the most interesting evidence, I think, comes from some of the missionaries and the settlers that, you know, they claim they discovered some of the sort of societies that survived along these lines in isolation, but, you know, the better word would be conquered and destroyed these societies when they met them. But, you know, for instance, some of the early Jesuit settlers that came to Canada and discovered the societies that had been living there along roughly the same lines that the bulk of humanity did for the first 100,000 years. You know, Lejeune, a Jesuit missionary, writes that the two tyrants who provide hell to many Europeans do not reign in their great forests. Ambition and avarice. Not one has sold themselves to the devil to acquire wealth. And indeed, you know, you think about the reception that some of these settlers and so on got when they first discovered or invaded these societies, or the reception that, for instance, the first fleet when they invaded Australia and came into contact with the Aboriginal society here. Well, the so-called primitive societies, i.e. Indigenous Australia or, you know, the other either hunter-gatherer or primitive settled agricultural societies, when they first saw capitalism or when they first saw things like the First Fleet, their instinctive reaction was to say, well, these people are insane. You know, the First Fleet, they've got this convict system. They whip people for no apparent reason. You know, they're all concerned about acquiring all these stupid gold coins and so on. This is just mad. And in one level, they were right. So the point is, however, not to idealise these societies or anything like it. They weren't gardens of Eden or anything close, you know. But the point is to say that, well, human nature, in the sense that it currently gets about, has varied hugely over human history. And that the thing that has changed how humans behave, well, it has not been some inherent biological drive. It has not been some inherent genetic programming or whatever. No, it's been far more about how the society you live in is structured and what the priorities of the society you live in are, rather than anything inherent to humanity. And any attempt, I think, to explain the development of things like the massive inequalities we see in capitalism today. Any attempt to explain why it is that in Australia today, the top 5% of the population own well over a third of all rental properties, well over three-thirds of all shares and similar business investments and so on, any attempt to explain these inequalities with some reference to human nature fails utterly to account for the vast bulk of human history and fails utterly to explain the vast bulk of human experience. And you can think about it another way too. Thanks. It's another way to come at the question. And that is to think, well, biologically, how have humans evolved? How have we got to how we are now? Are we in any way, in an evolutionary sense, designed for individual survival, for individual competition? And I think we've got to be frank and say no. To be perfectly honest, well, humans are fairly rubbish in individual survival. We've been given a fairly rubbish set of tools by nature in order to, you know, compete individualistically on our own, to get ahead on our own. You think, well, I mean, I can't run very far. I'm a bad example. I'm probably worse than that. Humanity as a whole, biologically speaking, we can't run very fast. Lots of land-based predators can run a lot faster and eat us alive. Can't swim particularly quickly. Can't fly. Claws, pretty much useless if you're going to defend yourself. Teeth, useless for offence and defence and all the rest. The one thing that has allowed humanity to survive has been its capacity to, one, deal with a whole lot of higher brain functions and so on, but to coordinate activity, to work together, to use some of the things we do have, like, you know, the amazing development of language in humanity that is far beyond anything seen in the animal kingdom. All of these things have been developed over millions of years on the presumption, language for instance, on the presumption that there are other people around to talk to. You know, there's some reason why evolution is pushed toward people having a tremendous capacity to work together, to communicate, to coordinate activities in order to be able to survive. So I think even from a biological perspective, the argument that human nature is geared toward individualism in any sense falls apart. And I think seeing that, it gives us a good basis to start to try and explain what's going on in the world today. Because I think drawing some of the important conclusions from that sort of incredibly short-potted history of the last couple hundred thousand years, well, you know, it gets across that the main determinant of human behaviour, in any sense that people talk about it, has not been this eternal human nature. No, the main determinant of human behaviour has been the priorities of the societies we've lived in. As society has changed from hunter-gatherer societies to settled agricultural societies to things like feudalism to things like capitalism, so-called human nature has changed along with it. It's been the structure of society that's been the main thing, not something inherent to humanity. And I think that is where you've got to start when you look at the world today and try to explain the fact that while people patently can be greedy, people patently can be selfish, can be individualistic, and so on. What matters is seeing what Marx called the ensemble of social relations that surround us. And by that, he meant the structure of modern-day capitalism, the priorities of the system, what the ruling class, i.e. the rich and powerful who control most of the ideological means of production, i.e. control most of the school curriculums, the newspapers, and so on, what their priorities are, I think, tell us more about the shaping of what people think is natural. Because, well, you only need to look very briefly around the world today and you will be able to find countless examples of greed, countless examples of individualism and so on. You think of any business leader, the Andrew Forrest, the Kerry Packers, the Rupert Murdochs of the world, all of these people got to where they were by being utterly selfish, utterly individualistic and ripping off anyone they could in order to get ahead in the world. That's what, you know, being in business means under capitalism. We also can think of other examples, you know. There are people, everyday people, people who aren't, you know, captains of industry and so on, that won't give to charity, that won't lift a finger to help their neighbours and friends and so on. But there are other people that will. There's a reason that all the charities and so on have people collecting down near the state library in the city. It's because, well, people are contradictory. People give to charity. People help out others at times, and then at other times, they won't. There are plenty of contradictory examples of how people behave. I think the only way we can explain this is by looking at the structure of capitalism and not looking at some supposed inherent tendency in humanity. Because just like the kings and the queens of the feudal era tried to justify their world by saying that it's all divine by God, that you're all meant to toil the land to serve us, I think the people at the top of capitalism and their various paid lackeys and so on, the ideological prize fighters around the think tanks and all of that that put out all of these papers saying that, well, free market capitalism is the best fit for human nature, well, at the end of the day, they're doing exactly what the kings and queens of Europe did, i.e. they're making up a bullshit justification for why the system should continue. Now, one of the ways to look at why I think people can accept some of the ideology of the system, some of the stuff around the need to be individualistic and so on, is to see that capitalism is structured to enforce competition, quite unnecessarily. You know, you think, well, there's unemployment today. You need to compete in order to get a job. Once you've got a job, you've got to compete in order to try and get a pay rise or a promotion or so on. It's not like there's not enough work that needs to be done to employ everyone. No, it's artificial unemployment in any social sense, any sense of what actually needs to get done to make people's lives better. But no, from a very early age, you're told that you will not get anywhere in this world unless you are prepared to compete. Think about it, even in the school system and so on. Like the VCE results, for instance, or the HSC or whatever it is in other states. Well, this is a ranking of not just how well you did in an exam or something, but it's a ranking of you against every single other student in the state. So you think right down the line, there are all of these things that structure in competition into the world today. And I think that can start to have an impact on people. And it's also some of the history that gets taught and so on. The history is written by the winners, and right now the winners are the rich and powerful at the top. You know, think of the people that get venerated in history, the people that have statues built about them in Melbourne City. Who's outside the state library in some giant, you know, 19-foot bronze statue? Redmond Barry. Okay, he's probably not that famous, but, you know, he was someone who was born into a very rich aristocratic family, came here, became a grazier, drove Aboriginal people off the land then, became a judge, was known as the Hanging Judge. He was the guy that hung Ned Kelly. Was renowned for his capacity to hang Aboriginal people and all of that. They build a statue about him. He's the person that gets mentioned in textbooks about, you know, the great history of Australia. So there's this ideological structure that tries to highlight, you know, the achievements of the rich and powerful, the achievements of those that are competitive, that have screwed one another over. And you add on top of that just the lived experience of day-to-day life, I think, what Marxists call alienation. You know, the fact that when you go to work, you've got almost no control over what you do. It doesn't matter where you work. Whether you work in a factory or a call centre or, you know, an office or whatever, well, you're treated like you're a machine. The boss is probably thinking it'd be better if you were a machine. They get less hassle and so on. Everything about work tries to grind people down, tries to tell people that they have no worth, they have no self-worth, and so on. I think you add all of these things together and you can see how some of the ideas about competition, about greed, can, you know, have impact from time to time. You can see how, not to excuse it in any way, but, for instance, when the government tries to whip up Islamophobia and so on, there are people that can take some of this on board. You know, to a greater or lesser degree, or, you know, when the government's trying to whip up racism to justify their wars, when you take into account all the things that are driving people down, telling them they're useless and so on, you can see how people can start to take some of this on board. Not to excuse it, it should be fought against, but you can understand how that happens, and you can do it without in any way referring to some sort of inherent biological drive or anything like that. However, it is worth saying that people are not totally manipulable. You think about, for instance, well, you think about the wars that I was talking about just before and the way they try to justify them. Well, yeah, they whip up racism, but how do they have to sell the wars in the Middle East? What did they have to do to try and get people on board for the war in Afghanistan? had to bang on about we're going to go in and help people. We're going to liberate people. We're going to bring democracy and freedom. It was rubbish, but the fact that the governments that were going in there to slaughter people and to prop up the US empire had to say to the vast bulk of the population, we're doing it to help people, I think this tells you that, you know, people aren't totally manipulable. People won't just buy anything. Certainly not. And you think about the Iraq War. Well, they tried the same thing again, you know. We're going in there to save people from Saddam Hussein. We're going in there to liberate the poor Iraqis. No one believed them. If it was true that people could just be won through sheer ideology, if it was true that there was some individual driving humanity, well, Bush and co, John Howard and co, could have just said, well, we're going to go in there, we're going to kick people. We're going to kill them, and then we'll end up better off. And everyone would have said, good. This isn't the way the world works. So I think that's the other thing that's worth saying. Okay, human nature varies, and people can take on part of the ideology, but it's never in its entirety. Day-to-day life tells people that unless you stand together, you'll never get anywhere. Day-to-day life tells people, on one level it drives people down, but on the other hand, it tells people that, well, we shouldn't just trust the people at the top. It tells people that we need to band together, otherwise they'll get away with more attacks. And seeing the class divisions in society as well is the other important component of it. Because, as I say, for the rich and powerful, well, it does make sense to be greedy, to be competitive and so on. This is how their world works. If you run a business, you need to be competitive. If you run a business, you need to kick everyone else. If you run a business, you need to stab everyone else in the back, because that's what keeps you in business. But if you're a member of the working class, you know, if you're one of the people that actually makes anything useful in this world, you don't get anywhere by this. Well, very few people do anyway. You think about the trade unions that have been built everywhere around the world without, you know, there being socialists around to tell people to build trade unions most of the time. This happens because day-to-day life for workers says, well, we need to band together, otherwise we'll be split apart and we'll be driven down. So there's those class divisions that matter as well, that mean that for people whose day-to-day life is working for a boss, well, there's a drive there toward working together. Because on one level, people already do it. People already cooperate to make all the wealth in the world. But there's lived day-to-day experience tells you that, well, unless you get organized, you'll lose out. Day-to-day life tells you that unless you try to overcome, you know, whatever artificial barriers have been put up between people, unless you try to work together, you're not going to get anywhere. And I think it's on that basis that I can claim that a better world is possible. And with politics and with organisation in the past, we have seen a whole lot of what is taken as examples of human nature today been beaten back entirely. You think of the big anti-war movements that have happened. You think of the movements that have won the vast bulk of the Australian population to support things like land rights for the Indigenous people. You think of the movements in support of refugees and all the rest. All of this show when there's a fight going on and when it looks like people are standing up for themselves, well, you can beat the ideology back and you can actually start to push back. Not just the attacks of the bosses, but all of these ideas that people are always just out to compete against one another. All of this goes out the window when people start standing up for themselves. Because on one level, well, actually, what's another way to look at it? Well, you think back to what I was saying about history before. Well, if history shows us anything, it's that human nature isn't static, that's true. But it's also that history has been one long list of revolutions. It's been one long list in changes in the way society is organised, and along with it, changes in human behaviour. This has happened countless times before. There's no reason it can't happen again. And I think it would be wrong to think that, well, all of the revolutions that have gone before us, all of the times that people have thrown off all the, what Marx called the muck of ages, all the ideological crap and baggage that the bosses push, all the times before that people have thrown all of this off and changed the way the world works, stood up for themselves and fought for a different society, to think that this can't happen again, I think is thoroughly mistaken. Because we've seen plenty of examples of people trying and people damn near winning. You know, this whole weekend has been filled with sessions about times when people have stood up for themselves, where things like, you know, revolutions that have overcome, you know, racial barriers, that have overcome sectional divisions, that have overcome things like nationalism, when people have started to stand up and fight back. I don't think there's any reason to think that this can't happen again. Indeed, I think we're almost in a better place than we ever have been in order to see it happen again. Because there are now more working class people in the world than ever before. There are more people to be organised in the trade unions. There are, you know, people cooperate on a much broader level around the world than ever before. You think about the Ford Broadmeadows plant. Well, in order to get a car produced there, you need rubber from somewhere in India, you need steel that's quite possibly been dug out of the ground here, shipped to China, processed, refined, shipped back here, melted in a plant in Geelong, then shipped to Broadmeadows. You know, all the electrical equipment comes from either Japan or the US and so on. People already cooperate on a worldwide scale to get everything done. On one level, we're in a better position than ever before to see a world where that cooperation becomes genuine cooperation, not cooperation forced under the whip of the capitalists. Because just as, you know, as I say, just as when the kings and the queens of Europe talked about, well, it's just in your nature to put up with this rotten and this unequal system, well, the people that today say that, well, it's just human nature that people are always greedy and competitive, and it's just human nature that there's inequality and there's people that live off the backs of everyone else, well, I think we've got to see it's precisely the same guff. Because, you know, it's the Rupert Murdochs of the world that talk about everyone being individualistic. It's the James Packers of the world that talk about everyone wanting to compete. You know, the Rupert Murdochs that have never lifted a finger in their life to help anyone at all are the people that are meant to tell us about, you know, what's in our nature and so on. I think we've got to see this for what it is, total guff. And we've got to say that, well, at the end of the day, people can be won to an argument for socialism. The fact that people are in this room is part of an argument for that. Because at the end of the day, it's just logical, I think. Like, if you gave the mass of the population a say over what was going on, I think it would be utterly inconceivable that you could do any worse, for one. It's one argument for it. You'd have to strive to screw the world up more. But it's also utterly inconceivable that it wouldn't get better. You know, if you gave the mass of the population a say, who would say, oh, we should get $13 trillion and give it to the bankers, not the people that are losing their houses? Who would say, well, we should spend, what's the arms budget in Australia? $20 billion? $28 billion. Who would say, oh great, we'll spend $28 billion on the military and meanwhile we'll have some poxy debate about what we're going to do with the healthcare system that's falling apart? Who would do this? I cannot imagine that if you gave the mass of the population of a say, they would starve people purposefully in order to make sure the price of food doesn't fall. Because this is what happens under capitalism. And I think any argument that this is somehow inherent to humanity is utter rubbish. I think we've got to see it for precisely that. And to say that, well, just as feudalism was gotten rid of, just as the despotisms before that were gotten rid of, we can get rid of capitalism and we can do it without worrying one jot about there being something inherent to humanity that stops us. At the end of the day, if you give the mass of the population a say, we can do nothing except to start to fix this world. Thank you.